This is episode 05 of Free As in Freedom for Tuesday, December 21st, 2010. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And I'm Aaron Williamson.
What's he doing here?
He was invited.
Oh yeah, I forgot.
Oh.
I brought him coffee and everything, but I just thought it would sound funny to say that.
I've already moved from coffee to tea.
My coffee wasn't good enough for you?
No, I'm just done with it.
You're done with my coffee?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
It just means
I made you free coffee with peppermint syrup.
Yeah, no, it was delicious.
All right.
But then I made him tea.
It's fine. I tried to make you coffee. Karen.
And you both made me come here and be on this podcast.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Karen didn't want my coffee.
But I did want Aaron to be here for the podcast. Oddcast, cast.
Okay.
Sorry, I said podcast.
It's okay. I'm the only one who says, well, Karen just says it too, but we're the only ones in the world.
Some people who write us refer to it as the oddcast. Some refer to it as the cast, which I like a lot.
There's people on Identica who say you should say AUD cast, oddcast for audio.
Yeah,
cast.
I've heard that too.
That's kind of dumb. No offense.
Now we're
to our listeners
the
out there on
Identica. We're going to get the emails on that. You realize that?
Yeah,
right?
Oddcast makes as much sense as podcast, I think, more or less.
It makes more sense.
It's the difference is between what you're casting to and what you're casting.
Yes.
Casting from?
No, you're casting on.
That's why I like the idea of just calling it a cast.
I like to cast a wide net.
You could call it a broadcast, which is still what it is.
Because it's on broadband.
Despite the newfangled technology we have.
It's certainly cast broadly.
Yeah. It's not cast at all. Actually, it's not cast at all.
It's pulled.
Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely correct.
I'm sure we could come up with a new stupid word to call it.
Ogpole?
So,
RSS-based audio distribution system?
So all of our software is vulnerable, huh? We're all going to die.
Only if you're running OpenBSD.
Right, so a very small percentage of us have potentially vulnerable software based on the word of one guy.
Well, I actually heard rumors of this thing probably 6 months ago.
Should we summarize what this thing is for our listeners?
Yeah, they hate it when we do what we're doing right,
right.
Now.
So the thing is that Theo Durrat, who is, I guess, the dictator for life of OpenBSD.
He left benevolent out. Was that by design?
No, I forgot the word. he got an email from someone claiming to have worked with contractors who had been paid by the FBI to insert backdoors into the IP security stack of OpenBSD. Is that a decent summary?
That's what the email says. I think Theo did a good job to just simply say, I'm summarizing what he said, but his attitude was, I'm not going to deal with this. I don't really think this necessarily needs to be taken seriously, but the better thing is to make it public.
Everybody knows the source code is published. Take a look and see if you can find it.
Right. So now some people have reacted to this saying, wow, if this is true, then this really calls into question the whole idea of all bugs are shallow, because if we've lived for what would it be like over 10 years now with some important backdoor in OpenBSD, then we really haven't been, then the sort of inherent security of free software isn't really playing out here. And that's, I think Glenn Moody wrote a blog post to that effect. But you're saying you've heard these claims about GNU software as well.
I've heard these claims about lots of different free software packages that have been adopted in various different industries. The claims, as I read them on the website, were so substantially similar to the claims I've heard elsewhere that I think this is probably a single-sourced rumor issue more than is anything else. Why it's being continually spread, I guess, is what I mean. I don't know, but I don't think it's credible, and I think that we could probably bear that out. Now, with regard to your point of is having the source available solve the problem, well, it's true that at any given time, there could be all kinds of security vulnerabilities, which in fact there are. Linux is somewhat, unfortunately, famous for having a relatively regular, at least not remote root exploitable, but local user exploitable root access bug, for example, and those happen quite frequently in Linux. I think the important thing is what happens after the concern is discovered and what's able to be done. A great example is something that I lived through, which is the cracking of Savannah and the GNU FTP site before there were PGP or GPG signatures required on all GNU releases. And in fact, that's why we started requiring it. But there was a period of time there we had to think about if somebody broke into the FTP server, they could have replaced GCC version x.y.z with something with a Thompson's bug in it. And if it's in there, then it could be being propagated around the world thereafter. We basically just audited the source code, and GCC developers and other developers of other GNU programs checked their local copies against what was on the FTP server to verify, did diffs and checked to make sure that it all made sense. And that's how we verified.
Have you talked enough about Thompson bugs on the Ogcast that your listeners are likely to know what that is?
I think I went through it once before. On the old show. Yeah. But basically that's actually, and that sort of leads to another point on this. The bigger worry I've always had is, and this is the first time I've actually told this story publicly, is I once asked RMS what C compiler he used to bootstrap the first GCC. He does not remember. So if that very first compiler he used had a Thompson bug in it, and he bootstrapped the first GCC with that, and we've bootstrapped all GCCs since then with a GCC like that, we could actually have a living Thompson bug floating around every binary of GCC that no one knows about, and it's not even in the source.
All our baser belong to Thompson.
Well, it wouldn't be Thompson who did it, because Thompson did it as an intellectual exercise in the old Unix code, and I doubt he
That's
went.
What he called it.
Yeah, I doubt he bothered to go into whatever compiler RMS was using in the late 80s, because he used some proprietary compiler, and he doesn't remember which one. I actually proposed at one point we have a project whereby we re-bootstrap GCC with a compiler written in assembler. And
even RMS said that might be a little too paranoid.
No, actually, I didn't propose to RMS, because I didn't think RMS would want to work on such a project. Right. It was RMS telling me that he didn't remember what compiler he used to bootstrap the first GCC. Don't worry.
I mean, going back to the point that Glenn Moody raised, that, you know, that somehow, you know, we have this belief that free software is by definition more secure because we can all look and see whether there's a backdoor in it, for example. I think that it's sort of obviously true that that's not how that works. You know, bugs get found when they have an effect on a user, right? And so if there's an exploit in the wild, if that happens, then somebody's likely to go and take a look at that code. But if somebody is not looking at or working on a particular piece of code, it's likely that nobody's looking at it. If a piece of code is working for all of its users, then nobody's likely to revisit that code. And I mean, it's not as though people are doing regular security audits of their entire code base, whether in the free software or in the proprietary software world.
No,
right?
But they are doing audits on certain pieces of a code that are, you know, that have, could have particular security issues.
True.
I mean, and this is sort of one of the things that SFLC touches on in its medical devices paper, which is that, you know, it's true that software is not necessarily more secure just by being free and open, just by being published and auditable, but it is likely to be safer over time, because when it's being used for critical functions, people do audit it quite closely. And if there is some problem with the code, you know, as you say, it's much more likely that the problem will be addressed faster because it can be looked at by everyone.
Well, and it's sort of ironic in a way that the rumor mongers are going after OpenBSD on this point, because Theo is quite fond of saying that he's either funded people or otherwise himself audited all the lines of OpenBSD at various times. So presumably this code has been audited since the time when they introduced this, and which means that it's probably unlikely to have these kinds of problems.
Yeah, as this sort of rumor always gets me wondering, I started to think about how you could introduce a backdoor like this. I'm not by any means a computer security expert, but into viewable, you know, free code that's available on the web, how you could do that without making it obvious that you were doing it. Because obviously you would have to take some steps to hide it, even if you thought nobody was going to be.
Well, I mean, people, when they look at this, this sort of is a, I guess, a corollary to never attribute to malice what can more easily be attributed to stupidity. I hate to pick on Debian again about this, but we had probably the biggest security vulnerability happen for Unix-like systems, certainly for Debian, and Ubuntu by extension, because Ubuntu, as much as they tell you it's not, is basically a derivative of Debian. The stuff with just screwing up about seeding the SSL library, which a guy did because he didn't understand the code. He patched out something because Valgrind warned him about it. This is a year and a half ago, I guess. It's 3 years ago now. And that was in Debian for a long time. And Debian was generating encryption keys that were often were easily guessable. And that was probably a much bigger security bug. And that was done by pure error. And somebody who wasn't, quite frankly, was probably not qualified to be maintaining that package.
Right.
So that's a bigger worry. And I think people getting together to try and insert backdoors is much less of a worry for the public than in the source code viewable side than just somebody doing the wrong thing and no watchers watching the watchers.
Yeah. I mean, I guess most projects have at least some sort of review process to prevent that sort of bug from getting introduced by a novice developer, right?
And OpenSSL does, and this is why the OpenSSL developers were so angry at Debian, because
they didn't upstream the patch quickly enough. Is that
no? It was the other way around. It was that basically Debian was carrying a patch that was wrong. That was a security vulnerability for many, many years. And we were all generating keys. I found 8 keys that I had generated over that time that were vulnerable, which now it checks it every time you run anything OpenSSL related on Debian, because they don't they check you against the blacklist on the keys. I don't know if people notice this, when you run SSL based stuff on Debian, it always checks the backlist when you blacklist of keys that were known to be vulnerable.
Interesting.
That were generated bad without proper seeding on the random number generator. I find it odd that people worry, but they worry about this stuff because people like to be, quite frankly, government conspiracy theorists. They like to believe that the FBI or the NSA is constantly trying to manipulate the world. And there was a time in my life when I subscribed to some of those conspiracy theories. I think that they're probably mostly bunk now. I don't think that the government is trying desperately to get access to all the stuff it can. And the example I often give, sorry to go on about this, but the example I always give is there was this really classic situation that happened that wasn't widely reported because it was a long time ago. In the late 90s, there was actually this mobster who was using PGP. And they were able to get all his email and basically collect evidence on him merely by physical access to his computer, installing a keyboard sniffer to get his passphrase, so then they could just decrypt everything on the other side by having a copy of the key and the passphrase. So the kinds of things that the government's going to do to get access to your stuff, you know, I'm more worried about somebody, if they really want to get my stuff, breaking into my hotel room when I'm at a conference and putting something on my laptop, right? That's right. The bigger worry than, oh my gosh, maybe the FBI put some secret back door into OpenBN. Yeah, right. Sorry, I'm ranting now.
Well, I mean, and now we can all take a look and see if we can find anything. I mean, I don't know that that will be easy to do.
But yeah, my trouble with it is it's a waste of time. I mean, this is basically troll. This is a well-formed troll. To force people to audit something that probably doesn't need to be audited. And they'll audit it, and probably nothing's going to come out of it. And if anybody wants an even money bet that the FBI had a backdoor, I'll take it.
Well, maybe it's worth tracking down the rumors that you heard a long time ago, or whatever it was, 6 months ago, to see if you can find the root of those and concretely compare them, because that would save everybody a lot of time. Anyway, why don't we take a brief musical interlude and come back with the real discussion of why Aaron's here.
There's a reason he's here?
Yeah. I thought I just showed up.
Everybody's looking at me as if I'm the one who's supposed to start.
You always start after coming back from
the show. That is not true.
For a long time, that's been true.
You're a liar.
I don't ever start.
You might have the one time we co-hosted when Karen.
I doubt it though, because generally the guests don't start.
No, he wasn't a guest that one time.
That's true.
Replacement co-host.
And actually, we referred to him not as a guest, at least the last time that Aaron was on.
Yeah, on the old show. Yeah,
that's right. But then we made a big deal out of it.
We dubbed you like special
special occasional co-host. Something.
which it is kind of weird that we say host in the US. Like, it makes a lot more sense, presenter.
Does that mean everyone else out there is a parasite?
Exactly. That's the point that people make. And the people in the UK have this right because they call them presenters rather than hosts.
So, or maybe it's simient. I've been watching a lot of Deep Space Nine.
Oh, yeah.
Presenters. We're presenters. And you're a special... Well, actually, this time you're a guest. But you have been on the old show, a special extra presenter. Vestigial presenter.
I don't even know where to go with that,
but... That doesn't sound that good.
SFLC did file another amicus brief last week.
Yes, we did. Thank you for getting us back on track, Karen.
That's what I'm here for.
Yes, so last week, the Software Freedom Law Center filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief in the Supreme Court in a case called Global Tech Appliances versus SEB, which is a patent case involving cheap commercial deep fat fryers.
So you thought that you were finished with this whole amicus brief thing during the whole Bilski thing.
I thought I was finished with deep fat.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if I really thought I was finished. Now I know I'm not finished because I think we'll end up filing more in the near future.
I think so too.
So I guess we can go back. I know that we've talked about it on previous podcasts, but should we talk about what an amicus brief is?
I think we should, just because I think some people don't listen to all of our episodes.
Does it mean you're Scalia's special friend now?
It does mean I'm Scalia's special friend.
I don't want to be Scalia's special
friend. But you're also Kagan's special friend.
That's true.
That's a little better.
It all sounds a little creepy, frankly. Doesn't matter how much you like really the justice. Does.
Actually, there was an... On Jeopardy recently, there was a question, they give the answer, and the question was supposed to... I forget who the person was, but... The middle name was clearly Maria, and the person thought it was Scalia, that somehow Scalia's middle name was a Maria.
Scalia,
it was some other
Maria Scalia.
I forget who it was, but some other Supreme Court, obviously a female member of the Supreme Court, has middle name Maria, and they answered Scalia.
Well, that would rhyme better.
Anthony Maria Scalia.
So, an amicus brief is when someone who is not a party to a case but has an interest in the outcome of the case files a brief with the court to tell the court, hey, we have an interest in this case. We would be affected by its outcome, so, you know, consider our interests as well. And that's what we did here.
And so, then the clerks just put them all in the trash can and they write whatever decision they're going to write.
Well, so
we hope not.
So we work with Evan Mogulin, or Aaron and I do, at SFLC. And he was well, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
And he was a Supreme Court clerk, for Thurgood Marshall. And so he has all sorts of great insight as to what is actually going on in the Supreme Court, which is fascinating to me, you know, as a lawyer, but just also, I think it's interesting to a layman because I never dreamt that, of course, and it makes perfect sense when you think about it, that in fact, a lot of these amici briefs are not read.
Right.
So it's really interesting. And that's part of the reason why, if you take a look at it, and we like talking about these amicus briefs that we file because, we can talk about them. And a lot of SFLC's work is done for clients on their behalf. And, you know, we don't have the right to talk about them. But because an amicus brief is filed in this case and in other cases generally and not on behalf of any particular client, we can talk about it. But you'll see if you take a look at it on SFLC's website that it's got these really clear headers. So like each section says, like, you know, in full sort of what the point is of that section. And the reason for that is that often the clerks don't get any further than reading those sections.
Right.
Section headers.
I didn't want to bring this up, but Karen, I do need to point out that you are mixing classical and church Latin pronunciation every time you say amicus. You said amici, and then you said amicus.
I said amici because usually we use the term amici to refer to more than one.
Yeah, it's
well, that's plural. That is the plural, but that's classical pronunciation.
Amici?
Amici would be the church pronunciation. Amici is classical.
And I said amici, I said amici.
Then you said amicus, which is, again, amicus. It would be amicus. Amici. Mm. You have to make the C sound like K's to get classical, and the C's actually sound like hard C's when it's church.
Well, we're all mixed up then in our legal layman's pronunciation.
Obviously, none of you lawyers have to take Latin. Like, why don't they have you take Latin?
It's because we have to... Because the more pretentious among us write a lot of Latin, but none of us actually ever pronounces it.
Oh, well, I took Latin.
So this brief also has the Latin mens rea in it, because the issue in this case is the state of mind you have to have to be liable for inducing someone else to infringe a patent.
So how do friars relate to software?
Well,
what does that have to do with a month?
The Software Freedom Law Center sells a great deep fat fryer. It's available from Sears. Okay, that's not.
Is it like
not.
The corn baller?
It is the corn baller. That was the first thing I thought of when I read this case. It's legal only in Mexico. That's for our Arrested Development fans out there.
Yeah, we can't get through an episode without television details coming in.
So this case involved a company who wanted to make an inexpensive deep fat fryer, and the problem they were trying to solve, and this is going to be a lot of background, but it's kind of amusing and also kind of relevant, so I'll go into it. The problem they were trying to solve with their deep fat fryer is there's essentially a skirt on the fryer to protect the fryer itself from oil that spills over during the frying process. Historically, fryers have used a heat-resistant metal, like a tempered steel, for this kind of thing. But this company, I guess it was Global Tech, had developed a means of using a plastic shield, because they were able to use a thermal-resistant ring around the fryer itself to shield the plastic shield itself from the hot elements of the fryer so that it wouldn't melt during operation. So that was the invention at issue in this case. So the defendant in this case had basically bought one of the plaintiff's fryers and told his engineer to copy it to make something exactly like it. And so the engineer did that. Then they took that fryer that they had just built, copied from the plaintiff's fryer, and sent it to a patent lawyer and said, hey, could you look at this and tell us whether it would infringe any patents?
Without saying that they looked at other fryers.
Right. Without saying that they had copied this directly from a competitor's fryer. So they got back clearance from the lawyer saying, I patents, you are free to use this design. And then they got sued because there was in fact a patent on this thermal ring protecting the shield of the fryer.
So as a side point, could that other lawyer get sued for malpractice for failing to find that, or is it just he screwed up and it's okay?
It's possible. I'm not exactly sure what the you know sort of duty is there, what the standard determining whether a patent lawyer in his search has exercised sort of due care in doing the search. So I don't want to comment on that because it's
unclear, you know, we haven't looked at the patent itself. So, you know, sort of when things get appealed to this level, they're really just very narrow points that are at issue that are being discussed, and you don't go and review necessarily all of the facts of the case.
Yeah, we talked about that, I think, on episode 02, I want to say.
Wow.
But I'll link to it for sure if it's not 02.
Okay.
So there were various issues in this case, but the one specifically on appeal was that the plaintiffs had brought a claim that this fryer, or that the defendant was guilty of inducing infringement by resellers of the fryer because they had shipped their infringing fryer to, say, Sears. I think Sears is one of the resellers. And by doing so, had induced Sears to infringe the patent by selling it, because you can infringe a patent by selling something that infringes that patent.
Now, was this available from the softer side of Sears, or was this?
I guess this is the tastier side of Sears. but I'm not really sure.
Fattier's.
Yes. So the issue was, had this company, when it deliberately copied this fryer and then, you know, neglected to tell its patent lawyer that it had done so, did it have the state of mind necessary, to be inducing infringement when it sold the fryers to these resellers?
But wait a second, its patent attorney had told it you're good to go.
Right.
So and how could they be inducing infringement?
Well, so the claim was, you know, essentially, or the sort of picture of the facts that was painted by the plaintiff was that they had sent this to a patent lawyer for clearance without telling him they had copied it, specifically because they wanted him to not find the patent so that they could say, we didn't know about the patent. Because if they had, the idea being that if they had gone and told him, or if they had looked for themselves, you know, with specifically for patents filed by the plaintiff, they would have found this patent almost surely.
So there's a new standard and an old standard
mm-hmm.
of what's appropriate or what would be considered inducement.
Right. So,
well, I actually want to get us a little bit on track. So what in the world does this have to do with software patents? Is that what you were asking?
No, I thought I was actually keeping us on track by laying out what the legal question is here so that we can then relate it to software.
Yeah, but I'm bored. I want to know what it has to do with software patents.
You don't like talking about fried food?
So
I like eating. I don't know.
So first, let's take a side road and talk about what it has to do with software copyrights.
Okay.
Because the question the court asked the parties in this case to brief for its consideration is whether the standard should be the standard that they use, the Supreme Court used in Grokster, which was the case that essentially determined that, that Grokster, the file sharing service, was inducing people to infringe copyrights. And the, standard that the Supreme Court announced in that case was that, the infringer had to be shown to have, purposeful, culpable expression and conduct, in order to be considered to have induced infringement.
Purposeful.
Purposeful, so, culpable
what
expression
the hell does
and
that
conduct.
Mean?
Well, yes.
That's always the question, isn't it?
I mean, since that came out of a 2005 case, there isn't necessarily a ton of development of that particular standard. But you can certainly glean from that word purposeful that you had to essentially intend for someone else to be infringing a patent in order
or
to induce. Yeah. In this case, it was copyrights.
And they just want to take that standard and just shoehorn it into patents. So this was a standard developed for copyrights, nothing to do with patents, but they wanted to just shoehorn it right
well,
into patents.
Well, what the Supreme Court is asking is, should that really be the standard here instead of what the Federal Circuit decided was the standard here? And what the Federal Circuit decided was the standard was whether the infringer was deliberately indifferent to a known risk that a patent existed, basically.
Indifference is very different than purposeful, culpable behavior.
Right.
Well, I'm curious how, so to take it back to Friars, even though I tried to get it off the Friars, how could they be either if they actually went to the trouble of asking a patent attorney? Because I imagine most companies a lot of times don't even bother to do that.
Well, when you take an invention to a patent attorney for clearance, you are, you know, there is always a risk that they're not going to find a patent that reads on the device, right?
And I mean, if you knew that there was a patent that read on the device and you brought it to an attorney hoping that he or she wouldn't find it and they didn't find it, then
you would still have the state of mind necessary.
Oh,
right.
Sure.
So the idea here was
Wait, are you saying that wouldn't have been indifferent? That seems a little indifferent to me.
Well, but that's also purposeful, right?
Yeah.
Well,
it's purposeful and indifferent.
It's a stronger standard, right? To say that, you know, you must be purposeful.
Right.
Than to say mere indifference.
Right.
So what the court essentially decided in this case was that this company only went one tiny step short of that. They had every reason to believe, the court said, that there was a patent on this thing.
Just to be clear, the lower court,
Federal Circuit, the Supreme Court hasn't decided
yet.
So they basically said that the infringer had every reason to believe that there was a patent on this thing, but they didn't want to have actual knowledge of the patent, which is why they just sent it to a patent attorney without telling them that they had copied something, because then they would have sort of...
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
They would...
So they withheld that whole story of getting the engineer to copy it from their patent attorney.
Right.
That came out, I presume, in evidence in the...
Right.
Okay.
And so this is...
So the fact pattern seems, but we haven't reviewed the original record.
And so this is why the standard here is deliberate indifference, because it seems like this company was intentionally trying to not learn about patents that read on this. They wanted to show that they had done due diligence, in searching for the patent, but they really didn't take the steps that they would have taken if they really wanted to know theirs. So that was the idea. That's what the court thought here anyway. So, but part of the reason that this case is problematic is that this deliberate indifference to a known risk is itself a new standard. And the previous standard, applied by not only this court, but the same judge, in a case that was pending at the same time as this case, was essentially, it required actual knowledge, it required knowledge of the patent. And the court essentially got around that in this case by saying, well, knowledge can include constructive knowledge, and constructive knowledge can mean if the original patentee, printed patent numbers on most of the stuff that it shipped out to market, then you would have constructive knowledge that there was a patent there. So, the defendant was trying to say here, well, you know, that standard that you announced earlier set requires actual knowledge, specific knowledge of a patent. And the court said, well, no, it could also include constructive knowledge.
I'm trying to understand all that.
Right.
It does seem a little bit tortured as far as that logic goes that you were just explaining to me.
What do you mean tortured?
Well, it's tortured logic, it seems like. Well, it's like actual knowledge. I don't really understand how you get to this actual knowledge versus constructive knowledge thing. And how that relates to indifference, like that's where I think I haven't drawn.
So you're not sure what the difference between the two standards are. You're not sure how the federal court, which is the court below, came to that conclusion.
I think I'm kind of lost. Is really what I'm saying.
Okay, yeah, I'd imagine our listeners are kind of lost. So what I'm saying is, one of the things that the defendant argued here was, well, listen, court, federal circuit. In this previous case, you admitted that inducing someone to infringe a patent, in order to be guilty of inducing someone to infringe a patent, you have to at least be aware that that patent exists. You have to know that there is a patent out there that, you know, that could read on this. And they said, so how, if we didn't actually know the patent number, the name of the patent, we didn't specifically know this patent existed, how could we possibly meet that standard unless you're overturning that standard in this case? And the court said, well, this word know, I don't think the word know means what you think it means. They said knowledge can mean either specific knowledge of a patent or it can mean constructive knowledge. And in this case, they said constructive knowledge can be met if you were deliberately indifferent to a known risk of a patent.
And this is particularly frightening if you think of it in terms of software. So if you,
yes,
if you analogize it to software, I think, and the way that these patent cases work is that if there's a ruling about a patent in an area that's completely unrelated to software, the rules have to be the same regardless of what kind of invention is being granted patent protection. And therefore, if something it affects deep fryers, it affects software too. And when you analogize this to software, it the analysis is a little bit different, or certainly more frightening from our perspective.
Right. So we've probably talked a lot on this show about how software patents are unfortunately blossoming and are being granted at an incredible rate and when I say software patents, I'll take a step back and say patents that software implementations. So like process method patents.
I don't know if we've talked that on this show. We certainly talked a lot about on the old show, and of course everyone,
right.
I think our listeners all know our position.
Yeah. So the
opposition to these things, so-called software patents.
Right. And what we often say is that there are a lot of patents out there. There are a lot of patents out there that are invalid, probably. We believe that patents that can read on software, at least in source code form, are invalid because they embody abstract ideas. And that was our argument in our Bilski brief. But anyway, there's a lot of them out there. And so if merely implementing some functionality that you are aware is in some commercial software product could be deliberate indifference to a known risk that a patent exists on that product, then software developers might be in a whole heap of trouble here. Under the Federal Circuit standard.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a little bit of a different situation when you're comparing deep fat fryers. You're talking about two machines that engineers were comparing against each other. And it's a completely different situation than developers that are writing a code base to maybe implementing a feature that is in a commercial product, but that they're not copying, or they're not.
Not even aware of.
Yeah. Maybe not even aware of.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I think I'll probably link in the show notes to RMS's speech. I'll find some version of it, either audio or written essay form, of this issue about how software is so different, because the things that you have, the types of problems you have to solve and the complexity of solving them are so different from a physical device than software. Because a great example here with this fryer, you have to worry about the heat on the thing and make sure that it doesn't melt when you turn the fryer on, all this sort of, those are the type of things you don't really worry about in software. I don't have to worry that, I mean, these days, maybe in the 60s I did, that I can write a piece of code that'll cause the computer to overheat.
But there are analogies for a lot of that stuff, and I really like Stallman's essay, if I'm thinking of the right one, but it's quite old. And
the danger of software patents.
Yeah. But it is somewhat older, right?
And, yeah, that's true.
And I've seen some good criticisms of it. I think it's worth reading.
So I think the worry here is that if this standard is, so the lower court decided that standard was okay and declared them in infringement. Is that correct?
The lower court said this is the standard, or this, you know, this is a sort of, an expression of what we think our standard has been all along. Mm-hmm. And therefore this behavior was infringing. You were inducing Sears to infringe by selling these fryers.
So if the Supreme Court upholds that this standard being applied to software would mean merely trying to implement something that worked the same as a proprietary program, if you were to infringe any patents, you'd immediately be,
well,
right?
not necessarily. I mean, of course, if this standard gets upheld, we're going to argue that it doesn't apply to the situation that you're describing. Because most software developers, when they're building something, even if they know that they're, you know, sort of theoretically their software out there is probably doing something similar, don't sort of have this same level of understanding that this company did. Nobody is,
very rarely do we reverse engineer things, which I guess you mean, right?
Right, or deliberately avoid knowledge of a patent. The fact is, we know there are a lot of patents out there, but that couldn't be enough under this standard to.
Well, you know, you're. I see Bradley is disagreeing with that, and there are so many patents that it's unclear how they would apply in a number of different situations, because they're so vaguely written oftentimes, and there are so many of them, and we have no idea what would apply to what, that trying actively to follow patents is, you know, for a particular piece of software right now is such a burdensome task.
Well, no one skilled in the art can actually do it. Because every time I've run into a patent that I had to read, I had to read it, then sit down with a patent attorney, go over it, talk about how the claims might apply to a particular piece of software, come to some conclusion that other patent attorneys disagreed with. I've never actually seen a universal discussion of a patent where everyone agreed exactly how it applied to any given piece of software.
And I think that's in particular what's so problematic about software patents, is that they're so broadly written and ambiguous, and no source code is published along with the patent to show its implementation. So it's so difficult to engage in that analysis.
Now, of course,
the reason they don't publish source code is because that can be turned into math, and therefore they would really be in trouble about the whole test of whether it's math or not.
I don't think that's the only reason they're not publishing.
Well, that's one major reason, right? I mean, it's one major reason, right? You can't list source code, because if you do, you're basically saying that this is a mathematical idea, which is what they are.
Yeah, and if you read the brief, you'll see that we talk about that a little bit still. Some of the language in the brief comes from the Bilski brief. So if you've read the Bilski brief, reading this one will be even faster, because you can just skim the stuff that you've read before.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to what you said earlier about the fact that some briefs are never going to get read by a clerk, much less a justice, we make our best effort to keep our amicus briefs, at least in the Supreme Court, quite short. So this one is, you know, a 10 pages or 11 pages total, but only, you know, maybe, no, I guess it's 11 pages of text, but small pages. So it's, I encourage our readers, our listeners to read it.
So you guys, where we talk about who, you know, who SFLC is and why we have an interest, why we should be listened to by the court.
Right. So you guys did a brief. Are there other organizations that did a brief?
Yeah, there are other organizations who did a brief.
I guess I'm more interested in briefs on our side of the question.
Yeah, well,
I'm sure lots of evil corporations did.
Hilariously, the last time I checked, I didn't see a single brief, for the respondent, that is, you know, the party that would be for the Federal Circuit standard. Rather, a lot of software companies
for the looser standard, not the stricter standard.
A lot of software companies and technology companies general got in on the right side of this case. And I don't have the whole list in front of me. I know that Newegg, was one of them. I think maybe
that's interesting
Google.
Because they're sort of a Sears in a way.
Yeah, exactly. They're a reseller. Yeah. So
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, you could, I mean, if you wanted to, maybe if we're taking another break, you could bring up the SCOTUS blog summary. They've got a list of all of the,
but we can link to it too.
Yeah, we can link to
it. I think we're actually getting close to a wrap up. So.
Okay. And now at this point, should we take questions from our listeners?
Yeah.
Operators are standing by.
I've heard somebody who did. Oh, was it? I think it was Phil Donahue, because he was recently doing some press for some reason, said that the taking callers is a whole nother, like, it's so much harder to take callers than it is to have guests or stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
I don't want to do callers. After hearing Phil Donahue say it was hard.
Right. It would be nice in this circumstance, because we have, you know, a fairly complicated legal issue here in this brief. And I think that it's really difficult to try and explain the whole background and the issue itself, sufficiently in this amount of time, which is why I encourage everyone to read the brief. But
I think that maybe the one thing that I think we could maybe do, maybe explain a little bit more is the difference between, inducement to infringe and infringement and what the penalties are. Because
right.
We're sort of talking, this test is about inducement to infringe, not about actual infringement.
Right. So, again, inducement to infringe is essentially, intentionally causing someone else to infringe a patent. Whereas direct infringement is infringing the patent yourself by making, using, or selling, an infringing article. As I understand it, there's no difference in the penalties. Essentially,
that's my understanding too.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're held liable as a direct infringer if you induce infringement, which is another reason why, the inducement doctrine really needs to be limited to situations where there's, you know, as we say, really knowledge and really culpable conduct.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that we're in such rough shape with software patents generally right now anyway, and that they're so hard to read and interpret. They're written so broadly. They're many times patenting what we consider to be non-patentable subject matter anyway, which is what Bradley's talking about math. That, you know, decreasing the standard and therefore increasing the liability of developers is just not acceptable.
So, who actually is on the other side of this? Because I've got this list up here and, we've got that Newegg one you're talking about. It seems like, Clearinghouse Association, which is probably just some reseller, is on our side.
The Business Software Alliance is on the same side of this case. Now,
this
I don't know
Microsoft,
what they're.
Microsoft, Facebook, Intuit, Netflix, Overstock, SAP, they
Yahoo,
seem to all be supporting
HP,
the
EA.
They're all supporting the petitioner, like you guys are.
Right.
And what's this Cisco and Intel in support of reversal?
In support of reversal.
What's reversal mean?
Reversal just means that they want the Supreme Court to overturn the Federal Circuit's opinion. Now, I haven't read the brief, so I couldn't tell you on what grounds.
Right.
I mean, they think that the Federal Circuit got it wrong, but the fact that it's, you know, for reversal doesn't. And, you know, and then there are two briefs here that are in support of neither party.
We hate you all.
But, you know, they could very
well. This whole
court's
out of order.
Exactly.
That's what neither party says, right?
Yeah. They could easily be making the same argument that we are and just not, you know, throwing their weight behind one or the other party, which is, you know, something that's done.
They don't want corn dollars to be sold regardless.
but yeah, it looks like there are no, amicus briefs directly in favor of the respondent.
Because they get updated for some period of time.
Well, at this point, all of the amicus briefs are in, so I think that this is probably the final list, because ours wasn't up there until well after the deadline.
So what crazy company would be on the other side of this?
What's that?
A patent troll. A patent troll would be on the other side of this because a patent troll would...
Anyone who doesn't make anything wants patents to apply as broadly as possible.
They don't have a great argument for being amici.
So why do you think your organization is the only organization in the free software world that's bothered to file an amicus brief?
We're not. Red Hat was on that brief that we mentioned.
They're along with
other companies.
Oh, they're way down there. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're way down there.
Yahoo, eBay, EA, General Motors.
There's a debate of whether Red Hat's in the free software community. That's an interesting question.
Okay. Well, as far as
people we know.
Right.
They're the only people we know, right? I mean, other than Yahoo and Google, but they're so big, you know, it's sort of they're both.
And we're a legal services organization, so we're on top of these issues. I think it's
on top of that, though.
So we follow these issues and want to make sure that the views of the free software community are heard. Mm-hmm. So I mean that's why SFLC exists.
I'm just wondering why other organizations didn't bother, or did you? I mean, I'm curious. Did you guys try to get? Did you feel like, I don't know if you did this or not, I know sometimes you try to get coalitions to file together, or did you guys decide doing your own?
This was frankly it showed up on our radar. Getting on toward the deadline. Mm-hmm. So we were under a bit of time pressure ourselves with this. I think that this case flew under the radar of a lot of people, which is why you see a relatively low number of amicus briefs for a Supreme Court case, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, Bilski, it was just legion. But here we've got maybe 15. I think it seems like a relatively obscure issue. Of course, anything that gets to the Supreme Court out of patent law is worth taking a close look at. But
so I'm curious, if we're going forward, do you think it would be better if more organizations other than yours were following this? Like, should, I mean, I'm a director of the FSF, so would you advise not that I'm asking if you give legal advice to the FSF on the air, but would you advise organizations like the FSF to be following as well and sort of trying to talk with you? To get, like, should this be a brief from SFLC, FSF, Apache Software Foundation? So should it be, does that weight have any bearing on the Supreme Court to see a bunch of nonprofits together, or does it not really matter in the end?
I think that it's probably open to debate whether a dog pile is, mm-hmm. is going is to be more it, valuable.
I thought it was like here. A term of art of a dog pile. No. Like a dog pile brief is what you call it when there's too many.
Right. I mean,
I thought I coined it. So now it is a phrase.
So you might make the argument, for example, that if there are more briefs filed in support of a particular party, then just the sheer number is going to make the court stand up and say, oh, there's a lot of people interested in this and opposing the Federal Circuit's standard. On the other hand, you know, if a single brief has a lot of people signing on to it, they might say, oh, wow, it looks like there's a lot of agreement on a particular perspective on this issue. So I think that really, as much as we like to guess about what's going on inside the Supreme Court, it's pretty opaque to us.
Yeah. I think logistically I know from experience that logistically it's very hard to get a lot of different parties to sign on to.
I've been in those discussions too and seen that.
Yeah. It slows things down immensely. And if you're on any kind of timetable, it's problematic. And what a lot of organizations do, and this has happened to me where other organizations have asked SFLC to sign on to their brief, they wait until it's pretty close to the deadline to give it to you. And it's in part because they've been working hard up until the deadline to get it ready. But it also is because they want to say, well, take it or leave it, because we don't have the time to negotiate back and forth. So it's kind of, I think it's a little bit of both, and it depends on the situation. But what happens is that at the end of the day, they're just, you know, if there's something in there that you wish were written a little bit differently, you might not want to sign up in whole to the brief that's presented to you. So sometimes it's just easier to file on behalf of a single party.
Yeah. And unlike, with the Supreme Court and their own decisions, it doesn't really look good when, an amicus signs on to a brief in part.
Yeah.
You know, we can't say, well, we agree with the brief from Red Hat in parts 3A, 4B, and 5D, and in the conclusion.
Yet the justices have no problem.
No,
with that
no. They do it more and more all the time.
Well, a decision is a little bit different.
Agreed.
Advocacy,
of course.
Agreed. I know that it would have been difficult for FSEP to sign on because you guys do say free software and open source are the same thing. Although I do know you favor the term free software, but there's a footnote that says free software is often called
because
it's very
confusing.
I know. I know why.
Well,
you
but
it.
I don't think
I also know that it would be difficult for me to convince FSEP.
But I don't think that I don't think that the FSEP would disagree with us factually that free software is often referred to by some people as open source.
Yeah, I think that FSF would demand the wording correctly to be. But anyway, it doesn't matter because I think you're right that it probably doesn't matter whether multiple parties have filed. And the other thing I noted is that in the introduction to what we were talking about before about how you try to sell the court on why it matters. But you're very boastful of free software. I appreciate it, but it seemed a little boastful to me of like, free software will save the world if you do this.
Yeah,
no,
we do talk about how free software is essential to the modern internet and to you know many if not most modern businesses et cetera, and we do sort of play up the importance of free software. I don't think incorrectly, but you know,
yeah,
the
it's,
point
it's not incorrect. It sounds yeah. a little bit sound like a braggart. I don't know. Does the court ever bother by that?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, it's a valid criticism.
It's okay, right?
You know, the idea is that we've got the first paragraph, if we're lucky, to get the court to understand why our interests are important here. And if they say, oh, well, you know, this is somebody who actually represents really important economic interests in our country, then maybe they will sit up and take notice and read past the subject or the section headers.
Well, I read the whole thing. So
I appreciate
I'm not a judge on any court, but
Bradley Maria Kuhn.
I'm a judge in the court of public opinion. That's what I say. When I say on Identica, that's really going to matter.
Who's the public in that sentence?
The public, the people who I have over 1,000 followers now.
Nice.
Which compared to like the Twitterverse is non-existent, right? I mean, Twitter. If you have 1,000 followers, you just signed up yesterday.
Right. Well, for Twitter, there are actually services out there where you can buy thousands of zombie followers for tens of dollars.
Oh my God!
I don't think Identica has yet reached the point where.
Well,
those services are valuable.
It's because people can get contracts by a number of Twitter followers these days. So yeah. It's not surprising that such services exist.
That seems like borderline fraud. If you're pitching yourself up based on your number of Twitter followers and you've actually
and
just
you know,
bought the followers.
And you purposefully bought a bunch of zombie followers.
Indeed.
Well, if you're marketing a zombie movie though.
Well,
I mean, you would want zombie followers. That's a real target
base.
Makes
good sense.
At least if it's a movie where the zombies win.
Do you think zombies watch zombie movies?
Oh, the ones where zombies win? Sure. Wouldn't they?
Are there movies where zombies win?
I don't know.
Zombie movies where zombies win?
There must be, right?
There must be.
Someone is going to write into us and tell us about all the movies where zombies win.
I really hope
win.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, there's probably more than one.
Anyway, thanks for joining us, Aaron.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. Thank you, and
until the next brief.
Well, we can have you back on for something else if you want.
We sure can.
Yeah, if you think of anything, I'm always happy to come by.
Okay.
Free as in Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. Free as in Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 Unported license. Please provide any feedback to odcast@faif.us.
Because a duck may be somebody's mother.
What?
Be kind to the fishes in the swamp, even though they may look like baby
brother. You don't
know
the alternative lyrics to that?
To what? I don't even know what we're talking about.
The song you were just singing, which is...
John Philip Sousa March?
That song is...
Maybe we're not going to let you pet our favorite pet skunk.
I don't.
What? What? I don't know what.
What is the song called?
It's our favorite that's gone.
Oh, I don't know that last part. So that song is actually called "The Stars and Stripes Forever,"
right?
Yeah.
Which has some various patriotic lyrics, which I forget.
Is that John Philip Sousa?
I don't know.
Is that even a person's name?
I think it is. Yes.
I can Google for "The Stars and Stripes."
I think this is an adequate test.
Yeah.
Stars and Stripes.
We probably tested pretty hard.